We killed her. We killed Debbie Reynolds. Shit.
Welcome to Geeks Without God with Nick Glover, Tim Wick, and Molly Glover.
We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, we're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
This week on Geeks Without God, our guest is novelist and screenwriter for Doctor Strange, C. Robert Cargill. So spoilers ahead, you guys, because we talk about it a lot.
We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, geeks without God.
Hi, welcome to Geeks Without God. I'm your host, Nick Glover. I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Tim Wick.
Hello.
And Molly Glover.
That's me.
And today, we're joined by author, screenwriter, C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, everybody.
Or just Cargill.
Yay, Cargill.
Hey, Cargill.
And, yeah, I'm back.
Frequent friend of the show.
Yeah, you. We recorded with you last at Convergence, talking about being... You're religious. You're twice before. Mm-hmm. That's right. You're a believer.
I am.
But we're not. We don't have you here to talk about belief. We have you here to talk about.
Who gives a shit? Really?
Something we can all agree on. A fantastic movie, Doctor Strange.
Yeah, Doctor Strange.
Which my movie all about belief.
Yeah, kind of. I mean,
wait, kind of?
No.
What's the movie?
We were pretty high.
She's not wrong. There's definitely a lot of belief in Doctor Strange. I mean, that's the whole thing, is that no one has the whole picture and everyone has a little pieces of it. And if you believe in the whole part, you can punch holes through reality and rewind time and stuff.
Yeah, kind of.
Kind of.
So how would you sum it up?
Yeah, how would you?
About in terms of how it deals with belief specifically, like if you were going to give us a pithy quote.
I would say that Nick was very much on point, except that I don't believe that anyone can get the whole picture. That's kind of the point, is that everybody has their own piece and can affect their own little bit of reality in that way. I don't believe that any one person can understand it all. That's kind of the point.
Is one of the gems a reality gem? Is that a thing?
In the Marvel Universe, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think if someone was wielding that, they would know the whole picture?
Perhaps. I mean, if you had all six of the gems, like with the Infinity Gauntlet, then perhaps you could embrace it all. But even then, I'm not entirely sure, because those rules are always very flexible.
It depends on who's writing, right?
Yes.
Well, it would be him.
Well, yeah,
in case you don't know, he wrote Doctor Strange.
Yeah, right. Of course. I think, I've read a bunch of Strange comics. I love the character. One thing I really liked in the movie was the very, like, Ditko special effects. Did you have any of that in mind when you were writing? Like, did you have any sort of as much like any visual influence in the writing, like in how you describe things?
Oh yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. That ties into the most asked question about Doctor Strange, which is, I was really caught off guard by, I didn't know, everybody would be curious about this, but I had a lot to do in terms of putting all of that stuff on the page. I wasn't the sole contributor to it. I wasn't the sole person coming up with the visuals. But I would come up with scenes and come up with visuals and write those visuals into the scene. And then, of course, Scott would come in and Scott would write visuals into it or amend my visuals. And then we would hand that over to the VisFX team, and the VisFX team would come up with their versions of it and go, oh, but what if we did this? And a lot of the times Scott would be like, yes, that's better. So there were always... contributions to it, but then when the VisFX team would come up with these great visuals that were something beyond what even we had envisioned, then I would sit down with the VisFX team and then type it into the script. So it was, those visuals are in the script. If you read the draft, the last draft of Doctor Strange, you will read things like hands coming out of fingers. You'll read about the trip, what we call the Magical Mystery Tour. You'll read you'll read about the Mandelbrotting that that was going on.
There was amazing Mandelbrot stuff.
Yeah.
That was,
yes.
The visual effects, and I'm not a super visual person, but the visual effects of this movie blew my mind apart. And it was to a way where afterward I felt like something had happened to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how else to describe it. I left the theater shaken, which sounds like I was scared or something, but it wasn't that. It was just profound.
I totally agree. The thing I said when we came out of the theater was like, some 13-year-old kid is going to go see that movie and have their third eye like pried open with a crowbar. That kid is going to eventually, like 5 years later, do acid, and all he's going to think about is Doctor Strange, and it's all going to be because of that movie, and he's going to be a more complete person because of it.
I'm kind of interested though, Tim. So you have never done drugs, and you don't drink.
That is also true.
How did the effect, like this, the visuals and some of the crazy, like mind bending stuff, like did it, I don't know, like did it make you feel weird? Did it?
No, it didn't. I don't know. I'm an intellectual movie watcher in for the most part. What it did, I loved the visual effects. Oddly, the response that I got from it was feeling bad for one of the first times in my life that I didn't watch the movie in 3D, because I was like, you know, I bet some of the shit would look pretty fucking awesome in 3D.
Yeah.
And I thought, to me, what I was thinking about was how it did a really good job. And I mentioned this to Cargo when we were together a few weeks ago. To me, what Strange did was create a different visual world from what we've seen in Marvel movies up to now. Everything else in the Marvel Cinematic Universe has felt, you know, I mean, it's superhero films, but it's still grounded in a world that we understand.
Yeah.
And what Strange needed to do, and I think did very effectively, was create a world that we didn't totally understand, that didn't make sense, that didn't make sense to us.
Didn't play by all the rules that
Strange,
didn't
play by the rules that we expect. And I thought that was effectively done, and the visuals were certainly a very big part of that.
Did you feel like you had a lot riding on this, Cargill? Because this is like the first big mystical Marvel movie. Like, this is our introduction to the world of magic for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Did you feel the weight of that? Was that pressure?
To a certain extent, yeah. But at the same time, when you're working with people with such a great track record, people who, when you're in the room, give such great notes and have such great sense of story and storytelling and movie making. And when you're working with someone like Scott, who's, you know, a genius, and you're being put together with, you know, a brilliant cinematographer and this brilliant award-winning visual effects director, and you have all this, you have one of the greatest casts ever assembled,
right,
of just amazing, amazing, like dream actors. It's very hard to feel terrified, because you know you have the safety net of all this talent surrounding you. And so it kind of frees you to kind of cut loose and go nuts and go as far as you think you need to go, because you always have these people who will reel you back in. But sometimes you go just far out enough that everybody goes, yes, yes, that is exactly where we need to go. And you end up being able to do some great stuff. So it wasn't as terrifying as you might expect, because there was just so much, such a great talent pool there that there was a lot, I had a lot of confidence that we were going to be able to pull this off. I didn't imagine that we were going to be able to pull it off as well as it was received. Like, I anticipated that we would, you know, that we would hit the target for a certain audience, and then other people like, oh, I just don't get it. But to see, you know, that strong of a critical reaction, to see almost all the critiques of the movie be, oh, it's just the Marvel formula again, and that's the problem with the movie. Otherwise, it's good.
You mean the successful money-making, award-winning formula?
Exactly. No, that's
no.
Just the, like, that's that, when that's the major critique across the board, and it's not story stuff, it's not character stuff, that it's stuff about this formula that people are familiar with. It's like, oh, it's another origin story. It's like, yeah.
I don't like the hero's journey.
If we jumped into Doctor Strange without the origin story, dear God, would the audience be lost? Is that the movie I would have loved to have made? Sure. I would have loved to have made a movie where we just, like, our initial pitch for this movie was the opening of the first comic where, you know, where the brigand shows up and Doctor Strange is already established. And he's like, yeah. Doctor Strange, I need your help. And Doctor Strange is like, all right, let's go into your fucking dream. And then we're fucking off in this dude's dream and Nightmare shows up. And it's like, holy, that's I wanted to jump in like that. But audiences aren't ready for that. Like, audiences aren't going to, they're going to be like, who the fuck is this guy? And critics, especially in 2016, critics are going to be like, who is this? We haven't established him. They're just running off and doing this thing. Where's our initial character development?
Yeah, you're fucked either way. Because either you do an origin story and it's an origin story, or you don't. And it's like, how did this guy come to be? I wish I had an origin story.
I think origin stories need to be skipped when everyone is familiar with them. I think Marvel and Sony has the right idea now with Spider-Man Homecoming, mm-hmm. because everyone knows the story of Spider-Man. Everyone knows the story of Superman. Yeah. Everyone now knows the story of Captain America. Like, everyone knows Iron Man now. Like, these stories are now ingrained to where 10 years down the road, if they want to reboot Iron Man, they don't need to do an origin story. They can just start out with a new Iron Man.
Seriously, the only origin story nobody knows is Batman.
Right. So how many times do we need to see parents killed in the alley in slow motion?
The pearls.
We have seen the pearls 9 times.
I think you see them 9 times alone in Batman versus Superman.
9 times.
No, in slow motion.
The Alamo Draft House this year, they have a supercut that they made of every single Batman origin story on film, including the Batman anime from Japan.
Amazing.
I wish we had Draft House up here.
I have a weird question. So do you have dreams about having been on set? Because you lived in London. You and Jess lived in London for a while. Because you were on set.
For about 3 months.
Like, is it... Because now you're back in your life in Austin, and it's almost like there's just this weird skip period where everything was totally different, and now it's back to the same. Like, does it feel like it, like a fever dream? Like, do you have weird, I don't know, like almost flashbacks to things where it's like, did that happen? I talked to Benedict Cumberbatch. That happened? Like...
Well, that stuff becomes... I mean, the thing is when you work on a film set like that, and you do that kind of thing... All that stuff becomes mundane.
Okay.
It's one of those things like the guys you still will geek out about afterwards are the people who showed up for a day or a half day.
Okay.
You know, where it's like I was in the same room with them for a period of time. Mm-hmm. But like when you work with someone like Benedict Cumberbatch for, you know, for 4 months, you know, over a 4 month period, and you interact with them over email, you see them when they come in the morning, you know, when you know, you end up at Crafty with them, that kind of stuff, and you sit around talking about the mundane stuff like, oh shit, traffic on the way in was just, you know, like all of a sudden it's not like, oh my God, I totally worked with Benedict Cumberbatch, holy shit, he just becomes Ben. Like that stuff becomes very mundane, and that doesn't rob the magic of it, but that stuff is the geek out stuff. The weird geek out stuff are just the weird, strange happenstances that just happen along the way over the course of the movie making that really kind of melt your brain, and then the weird fun adventures you end up on. But really the only lingering thing I have from that is my wife and I spent a lot of time in London. Whenever I would get off work, if I wasn't too exhausted and it was an early enough day, we would just hop the tube and go into London to have dinner or see a show or go to a movie. We would walk a lot. We were staying in Richmond, and I would walk a lot to, we would walk to restaurants and have just these great dinners. And we learned the subway system. Like, what weirds me, the weirdest thing now is when I'm watching movies and I see a certain part of London or a certain part of the tube, and I know exactly how to get back to Richmond from there. Like that's what weirds me out, where it's like, oh, I know. Yes. And I know how to take the, like, there's that game that's played at Convergence every year. That game about trying to find the tube home. And it, that always seems so alien and foreign to me until I'm like, once you've been there for a few months, it's hard not to know that stuff, because you just have to learn it, because you invariably end up in a weird part of town and you're like, shit, how do I get back to Waterloo from here? And then you're like, oh, well, from water, you go from here to Paddington Station, then you take this line down to Waterloo. And then you know, from Waterloo, you can get up and you can walk right to the river from the, you know, it's, and navigating that way is that the weirdest part is how much of London I know how to get around now. That's what's really stuck with me. But do I have dreams about that kind of stuff? No. Do I really look forward to my chance to go and make another movie and have this experience again? Absolutely. Because it's, and I, you know, I talked about it being the things becoming mundane, but it's awesome that it becomes mundane, because you get to, you have weird things like, oh yeah, no, I used to, me and my wife would come to set and then we'd go out and hang out with Tilda Swinton and her boyfriend after work.
Yeah. See, like was, I've had dreams where Tilda Swinton's in the minutes. I wake up and I'm like, oh weird. Tilda Swinton was in my dream. But like, it's not a dream where like we went out to dinner and then we talked about that email she sent me. Like it's that's really cool. That's really cool.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Actually movie related. Because and writing related, I think the ending of that film is fantastic. You know, the way Strange beats the villain, it felt very Doctor Strange to me. It's a different conflict resolution than you're going to get.
It was a solution that fit the character and his skill set.
And I wanted to know how much of that was you. Where did that come from? What in the process? How did that ending come about?
The construction of that ending, I wasn't around for. Scott came up with the basic concepts of it, handed it over to John Spates. John Spates wrote it. And then I came in and added a bunch of the character and humor to that last sequence. And then John Spates came in and did a polish of it towards the end of the process. So it's technically all of our scenes, but I had the least amount to do with the physical construction of it.
Well, then I'm sorry for bringing it up.
No. The interesting thing about that scene is, of all the sequences in the movie, that scene has the most of all of our DNA in it.
Hot.
But because the thing is that while the physical construction of that scene wasn't mine, I was the guy who came up with Dormammu Have Come to Bargain. The jokiness and pithiness of him in that scene was something that Scott and I found during the our working workshopping that scene and getting it into shape. And so all of us are in that scene. Like, John created the construction of that scene and it was fantastic. Scott had pitched him a bunch of the ideas that John ran with. And so I feel like that one scene above all is the one where you can look at it, and if you know the writing of all three of us, you can see kind of who contributed what in that sequence. It's the perfect example of the three of our writing styles all coming together to create a scene that really connected with everybody. Like that's a scene that people, that makes it for that movie.
Which one scene that you could say, like, that's mine, are you the proudest of?
The Ancient One's death scene.
Oh, sure, sure.
Awesome.
Yeah. That was something that I felt needed to be there, and those concepts were, I loved the idea because I'm a big fan of the comic book, and I really felt we needed a moment to get an idea of just how epic the Ancient One really was and how
beyond
weird the powers.
Time.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the idea of this character who can look forward into the future, but she can't see past a certain point. She knows she dies there, and she keeps trying to alter the reality time and again by changing things as they come to be, and still finding that she cannot escape this death. Mm-hmm. And then when she gets there, she feels that she's ready and just isn't. At the end, she's still very human and she's terrified of her own death.
The last scene between the two of them is really great.
It reminded me a little bit, and in only the best ways, of the David Tennant's run on Doctor Who, when he knew that he was going to die with the Nox and the stuff. Like, he knew what was going to precede his regeneration. And so, like, that, I don't know, that kind of, sort of, like, calm complacency of knowing what's going to happen in that way, but still you're going to fight until the end, because that's you also know that's what you have to do.
It's just like the final Tom Baker episode, which the name is escaping me at the moment, but the same way. Was it City of Death? No, that was anyway, never mind.
You mentioned the first Strange comic, and you've mentioned a few other comics. What did you read to prep for this? Like, did you go out and pick up some specific trades or anything?
I picked up, but when we were originally pitching it, I ordered all of the collections. And so I literally read every comic from the origin story all the way up through the 90s.
That's amazing.
I have a particular favorite Strange story. Did you get to Triumph and Torment? Do you know? It's the Doctor Doom Strange Ancient One story that's
It's, let me stop you right there. It's my favorite story, and I've been recommending it for a year and a half.
Hell yes.
I wish you could see his face. He looks so happy right now. Ricardo, he's like,
that
demon.
Is my favorite Doctor Strange.
I swear to God, I had a discussion with Kevin Feige, in which I told him in no uncertain terms of, like, you need to get the Fantastic Four rights back.
Right.
And he goes, why do you think I need to get the Fantastic Four rights back? I'm like, so that you can have Doctor Doom, so that we can write Triumph and Torment.
So you can do some sorcerer shit.
Yeah.
So we can have Doctor Strange and Doctor Doom go into hell to save Doctor Doom's fucking mother. That's a thing I want to fucking write.
Doesn't Doom get the Sorcerer Supreme title for a while too? There's some all kinds of crazy shit that happens to him. I know it's much later, but like, there's so much design space there.
Well, and like the art, even the, like, Mike Mignola, like Hellboy, he's the lead artist for Triumph and Torment, and it's like you can see the pre-Hellboy style in the art. Yep. And
awesome.
It's gorgeous. That's awesome, man.
That's the weirdest part about that comic, is when that comic came out, I loved that comic and it was a popular comic, but the one complaint was everyone hated Mignola at the time. Like, Marvel loved Mignola, and just the people did not dig Mignola's art because we didn't get it at the time.
He's ahead of his time. Totally.
He was. And so that art aged spectacularly, where now that's a selling point, where at the time it's like, okay, well, the art's not so awesome. The art is over-stylized, but the comic is great. And then it's like, oh, shit, I was a teenage idiot. And holy God, is the art of that book so fucking cool now. It looks like a book that was drawn 5 years ago, not a book that was drawn 25 years ago. It's absolutely fucking great.
It is aged really well.
So going into the premiere, when you went, how much of the movie did you know about? Were you certain about? Was there anything where you were like, oh, they did that, or oh, interesting?
Oh yeah, there were several things, because Marvel is very much into the reshoot process. Like, you shoot the movie and then they test it, and then they start reworking it. Like, that's built into how they make it. They just, they never assume you're going to nail it on the first try. Mm-hmm. Because they're making movies for very wide audiences.
Yeah.
And so you can't be as narrow as you kind of want to be sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so, there were things that we shot that I went in and watched. It was like, oh, wow, that's different than I remember it. That's not what I expected. Or, oh, hey, this is a new little bit. So there were definite surprises in there. But a lot of the stuff that I knew in advance was coming, yeah. You know, from talking to Scott or working with Scott.
Major plot points, obviously, and things, but major plot points, yeah. I think that's super cool. That's one of the things I've always, like, kind of, what I've thought about, not fantasize, but like when I've thought about like being in a movie and how weird it must be. Cause you know, for you, especially as an actor, you know, you're acting in a room, you're acting in a scene, and in your memory of it, it's the whole room and everyone and everything around you. And then when you see the movie, it's like, oh, I didn't know they were that tight on my face this whole time. And that's what we're going to show. Like, it's just, it's because your memory in the movie would be so differently linked. And I'm imagining it's the same if you're on set and, you know, witnessing the filming as well.
Yeah, no. In fact, it's even weirder when you're writing it because it adds an extra echo to that. So you remember where you were when you wrote that scene. You remember where you were when you came up with the notions of that scene. You remember watching that scene get shot, and then you remember watching that scene in a film. Yeah. So
you remember all the different versions of the line, and yeah.
It makes it does make it very hard to enjoy your film ever as a film. Like, that's the weird thing about being a screenwriter is that it's very hard. I just was able recently to sit down and watch Sinister with some folks actually be separated enough from it to start to see it as a movie. But I still have a lot of the connection with it. It was just a lot different experience than I'd had previously. I have not had that with Strange yet. I have not been able to separate myself enough to be able to watch Strange as a Marvel movie and just enjoy it. It's still this thing that I wrote in my fucking bedroom, you know.
So do you know yet if there's going to be a Strange 2 and if you're going to be involved? Maybe you can't answer that question.
I can't answer that question.
Cool.
You heard it here. Yeah. No, and you won't be.
let me ask a easier to answer question than that. If you could write any Marvel MCU property that either hasn't been added to the cinematic universe or maybe hasn't been expanded on yet, what would you want to write?
Captain Marvel.
Mm. Oh yeah,
I love Captain Marvel. Carol Danvers is the shit.
She is the shit.
Yeah,
and she's such a complicated character in the rights field. Like,
oh yeah,
half of her arc is in X-Men.
Yeah,
and so Fox owns half of Carol Danvers.
The Kree are tied to
Fantastic Four.
Fantastic Four. Yep. Yeah. So yeah.
So yeah, that's no, awesome. But but all of the binary years, everything that happened with her as binary happened in X-Men comics. So that's owned by, you know, by Fox. So it's going to be such an interesting story to tell, but I love her character. I especially love her arc during the aughts, you know. When she's just returned, she's burned out her powers as binary, stopping the sun from going Nova, and she saved the world countless times and nobody remembers her. Like, they remember her, but she's the people are like, oh yeah, didn't you used to be a member of the Avengers?
Yeah, didn't you used to be somebody? Like, yeah.
And she ends up becoming a drunk because she's lost touch with the power cosmic. So she's no longer in touch with the cosmos anymore. Well, and she feels isolated and alone. And so she's just a drunk trying to become a superhero again. And it's such a great story. And how, you know, when Iron Man shows up and drags her out of that bar and says, look, I'm going to clean you up.
He's her fucking sponsor. Yep. Yeah.
Well, and then that's how she does to Jessica Jones. Like, she treats Jessica Jones the same way and is like, look, I know exactly how you feel. You lost it. You were an Avenger and you lost it and you're drowning it in a bottle, but like, get out here. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, no, any other Marvel property I'd love to do Captain Marvel.
All right, quick question, and it can be short here. All right, which do you think is more important to you or whatever, however you want to qualify it, for Marvel to get back in terms of rights, the Fantastic Four or the X-Men?
In terms of rights, Fantastic Four.
Damn right.
Nick was mouthing Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four. Like,
but not, not, yeah, but we might be for different reasons.
Yeah.
Because the thing is One of the problems that Marvel has is the rights they have lack some of the best villains.
Definitely.
And, yeah. And the Fantastic Four have a lot of those villains. And if you can bring those villains in, if all of a sudden Galactus and Silver Surfer and Dr. Doom are all back in the fold at Marvel, I mean, imagine having Dr. Doom as a villain across several different titles.
He's my favorite comic character, Marvel or not, is Dr. Doom. So I'm all over that. But see what you will about the Fantastic Four, fan or not, they are Marvel's first family.
Yep.
For them to not be a part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe just
sucks. Plus,
so
much cool dimension stuff comes from them.
And all the Negative
and
Zone.
Yeah,
and
all the really
that,
cool,
Annihilus.
Like the dimension, like all the multiple Earths and stuff that recently happened. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But all the really weird stuff, like the goofy stuff, also comes from them too.
Yeah,
for sure.
Like that's the thing about the legacy of Fantastic Four is so many people have a hard time wrapping their mind around how to get it just right, because how do you balance the silliness of the Fantastic Four with what's cool about the Fantastic Four and what audiences in 2017 are going to want?
I want that little girl who played Lyanna Mormont to be Valeria Doom.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Sorry, I she'd be great.
Well, Cargill, we're going to get to five questions from you. You're going to give us five questions, actually. But I just wanted to note before we get to that, first of all, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us again. And also, you do a podcast, Junk Food Cinema, which is like a cult movie fanboying. No, it's critical too, though. But
fanboying is fair, because I mean the thing with the podcast is it's a podcast entirely about love. We never pick a movie that one of us hates or dislikes.
Yeah.
So it's always a movie where we celebrate a movie that we think you should have in your life, and so it's always going to be here's a positive look. Now we'll look at it critically. We'll joke about what goes wrong, and we'll talk about what doesn't work. But we always feel it's a movie that is worth your time to watch, and we hope that we can encourage you to watch more movies that you might not have in your repertoire.
Awesome.
I love that. I'm a fan of this movie might have problems or might be classically considered a bad movie, but we're going to watch it and it's going to be, you know, you're going to love it.
Goddamn load of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a movie that you have no complaints. Like this week we did Sneakers, and Sneakers is a perfect film.
Sneakers is a bomb.
Sneakers is nothing but awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There is no flaw in Sneakers, and so it's literally just a love cast of us talking about what's great about it.
The only flaw in Sneakers is that River Phoenix died so they couldn't make Sneakers too.
Yeah.
No shit.
That is it.
All right, Cargill, let's what's your first question for us?
All right, it's going to start easy and get progressively more interesting.
Okay.
All right.
Straight up, first one, what is your favorite scene in any Marvel movie?
Oh, Jesus.
All right, I'm going to just go out here and say that this was an answer that will change, almost certainly. I really, really love... So in Civil War, because I think this is something that's overlooked a lot, is when Cap is, you know, beating the shit out of Tony Stark because he's, you know, they're fighting, and he's like, he's my friend. And Tony Stark says, I was your friend too. And it's like, no, dude, no, because he is the only link that Steve Rogers has to a past that died with Peggy at this point. And like, he is what you are seeing is Captain America being a human being. He is experiencing all the rage and grief and loss and anger and frustration at the government and everything he's ever known is falling to pieces around him. And he has to fight what he thought was one of his closest friends to boot. And he's still so poised and classy of a man while he's doing it. I don't know. I love that scene. And I think that it's overlooked as being pithy, but I think it's really good.
there's so many action scenes that come to mind that I just want to be like, it was so cool when the shit blew up and the other guy, like the Captain America elevator fight scene in Winter Soldier and shit like that. Amazing. But I think my favorite scene is the opening to Guardians of the Galaxy, where Star-Lord is stealing the sphere that has the gem and or stone and dancing to the music with his headphones on and kicking the like space rodents and stuff, because I feel like it sets the entire tone for the movie. And, you know, like you just saw like his mom die and all this, you know, fucked up harsh shit. And then you get like some good music, a jolly kind of like, you know, ne'er-do-well Han Solo-ish.
Who can't smile when you look at Chris Pratt?
Exactly. And I just feel like it was something that hadn't really been done in any Marvel movies yet, and it just stands out. It's just something that makes my heart warm. Maybe I should go to a doctor.
Maybe you should. boy, it's a tough answer from... Well, I hate to pick from Civil War again, but... it is actually the battle with Spider-Man in Civil War, because Spider-Man is the hero that I've always identified with most closely when I was reading comics growing up. Mm-hmm. Spider-Man was the one that I was always reading. I was always following that character. And much as I love like Spider-Man 2, I think it's a fantastic movie. I love it. But I don't think until Spider-Man in Civil War that I'd ever seen anybody really nail the personality of that character. And so that just filled me with a lot of joy as a Spider-Man fan geek to finally see Spider-Man get nailed on screen. So
just so you guys know, the correct answer was the death of the Ancient One in Doctor Strange. You all fail. My favorite scene, this is the only one I will answer as well. My favorite scene is from Captain America Winter Soldier. It's the opening sequence, the on the left.
Oh, yes.
That is, in my humble opinion, that is the single greatest bit of character exposition I have seen in modern cinema, in which over the course of that scene, we are introduced to and fall in love with Falcon, and we see the bond between these two guys. And it's just so well executed.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have this great moment together. They're talking. They form a bond. And then Black Widow shows up and says, anybody know where the Smithsonian is? I'm here to pick up a fossil. And then we're just – and the way, you know, he Sam leans forward and is instantly flirting with her. Like, it's like everything about that sequence is perfect. It is just perfect, and I just absolutely love that.
It's Cap is humble and friendly, and yet like still clearly superior in blowing Sam out of the water by running
power. Still alpha as fuck.
Yeah, it's great, totally. All right, what's number two?
Question number two: what is your favorite cameo in any movie ever?
Son of a bitch!
Jeez, Cargill.
Gotta be a movie,
all right.
Huh?
All right, we think
cameo.
While you guys are thinking, I will share. I'll answer this one as well. My favorite is Marcel Marceau from Mel Brooks'
Silent Movie. Yeah.
That's a good one.
That is a really good cameo.
I'll throw out other titles, others that people have brought up regularly. Of course, Stan Lee in any Marvel movie. Other favorites include Sean Connery in... Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about sneakers, of course. The Orson, or God, now I'm all of a sudden blanking on his name. Darth Vader. What is his name?
James Earl Jones.
James Earl Jones at the end of that
movie. I was like, Anakin Skywalker? Like, I was super...
You know, okay, so... David Bowie's cameo in Zoolander when he hosts the model, the Vogue off, whatever it is, the catwalk off, where they don't just like bring out David Bowie and have him do it. They actually have to like, they bring out the like title card for him and they're like, it's David Bowie. That stands out because it's so heavy-handed in a way that like fits the movie and it cracks me up, and David Bowie just has to be there and be himself for it to be good.
Yeah.
That's the first one that comes to mind.
I am a Stephen King fangirl, 100%. And so I always love when Stephen King shows up in a Stephen King movie. But I really think my favorite cameo, and it's recent too, was in Ghostbusters. Bill Murray as the skeptic in Ghostbusters and all that, and being like, no, and being such a dick. And like, I really liked that. I thought it was a really, really good put on the spot. That's what I'm gonna have to go with.
Oh man, and I'm still here.
What about a Hitchcock cameo? Those are all good.
The Hitchcock cameos were all great. Yeah. I'm gonna go with Johnny Depp in 21 Jump Street.
Oh right. Yeah. Just
because another popular choice.
And that movie was surprisingly good for what I expected. And having Johnny Depp show up the way he showed up,
for sure,
I thought was fucking awesome. So,
well, not just Johnny Depp, but Peter Deleuze is in that scene as well.
It's right. True. Yeah. It's true. Yeah. So there you go. That's my answer.
Cool.
All right. Okay. Number three. So, over the next 10 years, we have two technologies that are emerging that are going to drastically reduce the workforce. We've got driverless cars and we've got non-sentient AI. Both are going to be pervasive in our life because of all the advantages that come with them. But my question to you guys is, which one scares you the most and why?
AI. Drastically, much scarier. Automated workforce. We can figure that out. We can solve that with things like universal income, we can humanity our way around that, provided we get our shit together. AI is something where, like, the second we have built something that's conscious or whatever, it can be self-improving, and the way in which we look at, you know, processor speeds, memory sizes, any of these technologies that so drastically jump ahead on themselves, AI will do the same. AI will be able to figure itself out and upgrade it faster than we can, or create subsequent AIs. And I think
like that... IG-88.
Right, sure. Yeah, no, totally. I think that... AI is scary and probably not something like a true AI is probably something we'll never have to worry about. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but close enough is super dangerous still.
I think I got to go with the non-sentient AI as well. I worry about where that can go. And frankly, driverless cars, I fucking hate being in traffic, and the concept of not having to drive, as much as there are issues in how that's going to affect the workforce and everything else, to me that just seems like great. I really enjoy the concept of being able to get into my car and have my car take me to where I'm going, and be able to read a book and not pay attention to shit. So
this last season of Black Mirror has an episode that is it's the first episode, the one with Bryce Dallas Howard, that's basically like the concept of having like a rating system that replaces, it becomes the rating system for everything. It's like your credit rating or your background check.
Woofie.
But it's like Woofie and Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, but it's like that the concept that your number and what people think of you in your day-to-day life, in your interactions with strangers, the people who know you and people who don't, could then translate into your ability to get a job or to get it. And they're trying this out in China.
Yeah.
This is something that actually does exist in China, that you can report your neighbors for bad behavior, and that can then cause them to get bad performance reviews at work
it's a citizen rating.
Be able to get a car. And yep. And that is a concept that scares the shit out of me. The idea that it's like McCarthyism taken to the extreme, that I might not be able to get a car because I swore at somebody in traffic and a bunch of people saw me and my rating dipped down just 0.1 today, and therefore I can't get that car today.
Hmm.
You know, it's that to me is crazy.
Right on.
All right. Four?
Tim?
Oh, Tim answered.
Yeah, yeah.
I did. It wasn't very memorable.
All right, number four. What do you think the kids of tomorrow, whether it be 20, 30, 40 years from now, are going to look back on that we have a part of our daily lives today and think is totally foreign?
That's a good question.
Well, like, I think, you know, oh, go ahead.
I think, you know, a car that you can drive.
Yeah.
I really think that that's going to be something that, that isn't going to make any sense to them. The concept of rush hour, you know, if cars are driving themselves, suddenly cars are self-regulating and traffic jams, they don't become a thing of the past, but they're going to be a thing that people don't understand in the same kind of way. You know, you're going to complain about a 5-minute delay instead of a 2-hour delay. That's going to be a really big change, I think.
Something that I'm already seeing as like a person who is, I was born in 81. So like, I'm like the last generation of people that remember a time before the internet that, what, you know, where, when I was sentient, whatever. I think that in the future, it'll be similar where people just can't imagine a time before, a time with privacy. I think the concept of privacy is going to be technologically is going to be something that is reminisced about fondly or viewed as a strange thing of the past, where anyone who doesn't have all their information available with some foraging or paying or whatever, or even just, you know, paying for services with your information, you know, Facebook and things like that. I think that the concept of privacy is going to be baffling in the future to kids. They'll just be like, what do you mean? You don't know what so-and-so ate or where they live or anything like that.
Kind of on a line with that, I think that in the future, targeted marketing will be so constant that it will seem odd to think that there was ever an advertisement that wasn't personalized to you, like Minority Report style.
Hmm.
I think that people are already shaping, you know, we're shaping our own experiences in terms of, you know, Facebook sends us ads based on what it thinks we like, based on what we've talked about, you know, you get different things based on that. And I think that along with Nick's, you know, lack of privacy concept is that people will be like, oh, you mean you didn't always just get targeted ads? Like, you used to get ads for things that didn't apply to you. Like, oh, funny, women used to get spam about Viagra. That's so weird. Why would they even bother? Why would they take the time? Yeah. I think that in the future, all the advertising, the near future, that it's going to be so targeted that I won't see ads for things that I would never buy.
People that don't drive won't see ads for
cars. People that don't drive won't see ads for cars. Yeah, yeah, all that. I think right. they'll figure out, because so much of it's going to be internal.
Yeah.
I did, by the way, come up with a better answer. It's a shorter answer. Mm. My answer is winter.
Oh, that's a sad. Where's my womp womp?
It's gone now.
Question number 5.
Question number 5. All right. This one is easy and probably the most fun. You guys are apparently atheists, I hear. However, you guys die and it turns out you were wrong. There is an afterlife after all.
Mm.
Which serious afterlife do you wish exists? Which religion do you wish had it right?
I say true. I want Valhalla. I mean,
Valhalla is just one of the heavens. That's only a few.
I like the idea of there being different heavens for different people who get along better. I like the idea of there being, I've always liked a pantheon. And the concept of it being like, you know, heaven is what your spirit would be happiest experiencing. So if you're a warrior, you go to a feasting hall where you brag and tell tales and drink ale and, you know, and the other heaven. Yeah. That's what I've always liked. Norse pantheon.
I don't know that it's a heaven, I guess. What I would say.
No, it doesn't have to be a heaven. Just which religion that's a serious religion.
I would go with the Hindu belief in reincarnation.
Hmm.
Because I think I would rather live another life than an eternal afterlife of one thing.
Really? After the one you just had?
Well, there, it can't be much worse.
It literally could.
And I don't mean that because I love point. You. Because I love you, Pat. You're great. And I actually, yeah, this life is good. And it could be a lot worse. But the concept of reliving, of coming back and living a life as a different person and having a different set of experiences and growing from that as an individual through multiple lifetimes, I like that. That's what I would pick.
But the nice thing about, you know, reincarnation is if you go with like a certain varieties of reincarnation, you get like a nirvana as an endpoint, as like a somewhat afterlife / in life end goal. That's kind of cool. Pure enlightenment sounds pretty rad. I'd like to, I don't know, have my consciousness merged with the universe. That sounds nifty. I don't know, man. Everything Abrahamic sounds, I mean, it's paradise, right? Like an Abrahamic religion, heaven is paradise. It's perfect, blissful eternity to some.
It's essentially like the nirvana. It's like the enlightenment. Yeah. It is, you are one with God. You are in whatever paradise is imagined. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like a cop out to say the answer that sounds best is the one that's it's like, who's the best protagonist? Well, this protagonist I wrote, it starts out with, he is perfect in every way. You know, it's just like, I guess I'd say heaven, the Abrahamic religion's heaven, because in its own definition, it's, you know, perfect eternal bliss, I guess. I don't mean to sound so skeptical and doubtful, but that's what I would go with.
Why would you sound so skeptical and doubtful about something you don't believe?
That's right. It feels like a cop-out answer to say like the perfect one, but I don't know. I kind of like that. I kind of like, though, like, I like religions where you just get to still be yourself and not be, have a perfect eternity too, though. Yeah. But who can pass up a perfect eternity? Like, that's not a thing you can pass up. I don't know. Yeah, that's my answer.
If that's what's behind door number one, it's hard to turn it down.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will also like to go on record as saying that if I die and there's an afterlife, in no way will I be like angry or anything. I'll just be like, well, I'll be. It'll just be like a, all right then. Like, I will be glad. I don't know. I'll just be glad to know.
I'll be surprised, but
yeah.
Not,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I didn't expect you guys would be bitter about it. I mean, I expect you guys would show up and be like, really? You couldn't drop a couple more hints that were more reliable than a book? Yeah.
If it was pearly, if it was like straight up pearly gates, like harps, like the whole thing, I would be like, man, you got to go down there. Like, you got to go down there and make them know this is how it is.
I'd be like cartoon heaven.
It feels,
I'd
be like, super,
why is it the only people you told were political cartoonists?
Yeah, I'd be like, it feels this. I feel like there's got to be something you can do. They'll be like, we sent the book. I'd be like, not the book. You gotta do something new. We need something new.
Yeah, I feel like I like the idea of that heaven, like that this mismanaged heaven where there's just this overworked guy whose job it is to connect and talk with, you know, connect the word of God to earth. And he's like, he takes a shortcut and he's like, Republicans seem to believe in me. I'll talk to them.
Or even better, he's like, I get up there and I'm like, dude, you got to do something. I sent a book. That was 2,000 years ago. That was 2,000 years ago? Oh, shit. Like, yeah, no one knows you. No one thinks, half the people don't think it's real down there. Fuck. Like, send a new book, I guess.
I love this alternate reality.
My advice would be to make it shorter.
Yeah.
I actually, it reminded me of something that I saw online today where somebody was quoting Jesus from the Last Supper, where he looks at the bill and he's like, who ordered wine?
Yeah. So, of all the things.
So anyhow.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Cargill, for being our guest, for coming back, for another one, for talking to us about Doctor Strange, and for your questions, of course. Listeners, if you want to answer Cargill's 5 questions, leave a comment, either, you know, Facebook, geekswithoutgod.com, respond on Twitter if they can fit them in 140. Otherwise, check out Junk Food Cinema, Cargill's podcast. Go read a book. If you like fantasy books, The Dreams and Shadows. I finally finished the second one, and I do love it. And
we should point out that Cargill is the author of Dreams and Shadows.
Yeah, and Queen of the Dark Things, right? Yeah, which I finished the second one with audiobook, and I that was a great time. I really loved that. Otherwise, we'll see a Convergence in July, right, man?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yay!
Hell yes! All right.
Of course, I'm coming. We have a returning friend, a guest, who's finally coming back after years. I don't know if it's public yet, but I'm very excited about it.
He hasn't said it publicly, so it's probably not quite public yet.
Tease. All right.
But I'm very excited.
People have to keep an eye out for that. Otherwise,
of course, he said it publicly. He tweeted to you, for God's sake. Well, all right. Never mind.
We're Geeks Without God. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or geekswithoutgod.com. Otherwise, we'll see you all next week. Bye.
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 By the hoary hosts of Hogoth. We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks. Geeks Without God.
Until next time, you can find us blogging and listen to past podcasts at geekswithoutgod.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at geekswithoutgod.
We're geeks.
We're geeks.
We're geeks without God.
We're geeks.
We're geeks.
We're geeks without God.
We're geeks. Geeks without God.
All right. Well, I will let you guys go. I'm going to go piss like a racehorse.